Welcome to Jessup Think. I'm your host, Mark Moore. And today on the show, I'm delighted to be joined for the first time by Cynthia Schaefer-Elliott, Associate Dean of Faculty of Theology and Professor of Archaeology and Hebrew Scripture.
That's what they tell me.
That's on your business card, so that's why I put it here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hey, it's really great to have you. I know you're, you know, kind of a professional podcaster, so I just, you know, it's good to have you on one of our shows now.
I'm delighted to be here.
Hey, that's good. And back on the show, friend of the show, Libby Backfish, also professor of Hebrew Scripture, so welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
And when you come back a second time, that's when you become friend of the show.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Not that you're not a friend, Cynthia, but
just not a friend of the show.
Friend of the show means you've come back. You've answered my email again that I've
or
asked
the time
you.
Just worked out.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It fits in your schedule. But I'm excited to have you both on the episode today because I want to talk about what I think is an extremely interesting topic. That of monotheism and ancient Hebrew culture. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, maybe some people hear that and that's not as exciting to them. But when I hear that, I get excited and I want to kind of know more because I feel like this topic has been maybe intriguing scholars of late, or I've just been hearing more about it lately. And there seems to be a disconnect between kind of maybe our current definition of monotheism and the experience of the ancient Israelite in terms of monotheism. And so I just think it's maybe really interesting, and I think it actually exposes some theological issues that I think are really important in dealing with language. We're going to do a little language today, so get your Hebrew ready. I did actually take, so I was an English and writing undergrad, full disclosure, and as an elective, I took Hebrew because
good
I...
Good for you.
See?
Well
so
done.
Look at that thing. I knew that
you need
would
to tell our students
score
that.
Some. Yeah, exactly. I will. I'll start preaching that. You can take these as electives. But I think this, so language-wise, I think it's going to really open some things up maybe in theology. So when we look at that and we look at the maybe current definition... Mostly it is, and probably like the person on the street, if you ask them to define monotheism right now, it would be similar to the definitions in Webster and that, this idea of belief in a single God, mm-hmm. or maybe even more strongly, a belief that only one God exists. I think you hear that a lot. How does that definition maybe jive with the ancient Israelites' experience of monotheism?
It's a good question.
Hey, you know, I try.
Do you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah, I think, Mark, you were getting at something. There's a disjunction between how we would define it, how they would define it, and also the questions we're asking and the questions they're asking. So we're asking how many gods exist. And I think they were asking how many gods do we worship?
Mm. Oh, that's
and so it's much more
that's
an
a
issue.
Really
of,
good distinction. Yeah, much I might just borrow that.
It's a freebie for you. So I think it's an issue more of praxis for the ancient Israelites because they were concerned with who do we worship, and whereas now we think of it more theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can learn a lot from the ancient Israelites because I think sometimes we think that just thinking about God theoretically is enough.
Right.
But really, we need to make good on those thoughts and how do we worship him alone well.
Mm. Right, yeah. Just that idea of, hey, I believe God exists, and we maybe stop there, but much like different to say worship of
how do you give
God.
Him your exclusive worship?
Mm.
Yeah, I think that's important. And that's what was in the forefront of Israel's mind.
And how were, and so would they have used terminology like that? The idea of monotheism, or I mean, that is obviously a term we're maybe putting back on them.
Definitely a term we're putting back on them. Mm-hmm. It's a philosophical category.
Yeah.
But we do have similar language, especially developing throughout Scripture. So especially in Isaiah, we have a lot of language about the Lord alone is God.
Yeah.
But we do, and I'm sure Cynthia would agree, we see this developing. So it's kind of in seed form in the Torah. And we have it in Deuteronomy. It's clear, but that may be a later editorial edition. Mm-hmm. And then we have it really developed in especially 2nd and 3rd Isaiah. This very clear that God, you know, Yahweh alone is God.
Right.
But again, I don't think they were necessarily thinking philosophically. Isaiah's point was, if God alone is God, worship him alone. Mm-hmm. Don't put your trust in Egypt and Assyria and yourselves. Put your trust in Yahweh.
Yeah, and is that kind of where the Shema? So I know you referenced in Deuteronomy, and even as a maybe a later addition, that idea of the Shema kind of maybe points towards that too. The idea
Absolutely.
Of worship and love, rather than "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God exists, and He exists as one."
Right. That it's not just about, as Libby was saying, about as far as worship. It's not just about going and doing these proper things as far as, you know, sacrifices and going to the shrines and going to the temples, mm-hmm. that worship of Yahweh and Yahweh alone, very exclusive worship of Yahweh.
Right.
As opposed to Yahweh and, like we see in the archaeological record, and we see in the textual record too, you know, we see over and over and over again Israel and Judah really struggling with this idea of being just worshiping this one God and one true God alone.
Right.
As opposed to being part of the wider kind of Canaanite, you know, pantheon of gods.
Right.
So even when in Deuteronomy in the Shema, when it talks about worshiping and worshiping God alone, it's also trying to make sure that the people see that worship is not just about those high holy days. It's not just about the sacrifices.
Yeah.
It's a holistic, it's an everyday thing. It's when you lie down. It's when you get up. It's when you're home. It's when you're away. And so that's one reason I think that the Shema has become such an important piece within even Judaism today, because it's showing that more holistic nature of worship.
Yeah. And maybe, yeah, separating that from just the worship experiences in tabernacles or shrines, but that this is all of your life.
Right.
And really that call to worship besides existence. And I think maybe that's what makes people nervous today talking about monotheism in ancient Hebrew culture, because when we think, if we define it as only one God exists, and then we say, well, Hebrew culture didn't really think that. Then we're like, so they believed all these gods existed? And
right.
It kind of makes us question, you know, and I've talked to people and students and friends who are like, wait, what is, you know? And I do think it's, yeah, we're asking and answering different questions than they were. And I think highlighting the idea that this is a call from God to worship Him alone, right? And the fact that they really struggled with that.
They did. And when you talk to students or people about it in general, and they think, oh, no, Israel and Judah, well, they'll say Israel, but I always make sure Israel and Judah gets
right,
in there.
Yeah. It gets confusing for
it
people.
Does.
I'll give them the benefit of
it. It really
doubt.
Does. But that, you know, they say, oh, Israel worshipped Yahweh and Yahweh alone. And I think, well, and I get a little snobby. Like, have you read the Old Testament?
Right.
Which most people haven't.
I was gonna say
anymore.
You could probably answer that. No.
Yeah,
no, you haven't.
They haven't. Or they've read the parts of it that, you know, they read at, you know, Christmas or you know, certain things but if you look at even just the text, even if you don't even take the archaeological record into consideration, if you're just looking at the text, you see over and over and over again Israel and Judah really struggled with this.
Yeah.
And it talks about them worshiping these other gods, but they weren't supposed to.
Right, right, right.
And that's an important distinction, too,
is
between what they were doing, which is blatant, constant, perpetual idolatry and apostasy, and what they were called to do.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, we have to be careful to distinguish what they were doing as something that was wrong, you know, in contrast to what they should have been doing.
And that this was something that they learned from. You know, this was,
if they're
looking at the exile and thinking about, okay, well, why did we get here? This is one of the conclusions that they came to, is that they kept breaking the covenant by worshiping other gods.
Right.
And so if people say, well, no, they didn't worship other gods, and I think, well, then you, first of all, you need to look in the text mm-hmm. itself, because the text itself says it often.
Right, right.
But then also, if you take the archaeological record into consideration, that you can't ignore that either. You can't ignore the text or the artifact. And those artifacts are there. I mean, I've excavated numerous of these idols. We call them figurines.
But right, right. Yeah, so you've actually excavated and seen some of the figurines from a traditional Jewish home.
Right. They're mostly found in homes. You've got anthropomorphic and zoomorphic figurines. So zoomorphic ones are, of course, animals.
Zootopia.
Yes, exactly. I love that movie.
Yeah, it is a good movie.
It was a really good movie. But we find the zoomorphic ones, and they're not as common as the anthropomorphic ones. But the zoomorphic ones are usually, you have kind of donkeys or horses. Some people say horse and rider, but, you know, horse, maybe more like a donkey. Mm-hmm. And then also, of course, the calf or the bull.
Right.
You know, Baal symbol, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, we have anthropomorphic figurines, which you've got that horse and rider figurine, and it's supposed to be kind of a guy, but it's very bland. You can't really, you know, tell. But then we get these female figurines, and most of the ones that we find in households are more often than not these female figurines, and they're almost always of women, and these women are usually in some sort of you've got ones that look like they're holding drums or kind of tambourines. And then you've got ones that are kind of just pillar figurines where their hands are kind of at their side, but they're often nude. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them often have, you know, very large breasts, or they're, some people would say, oh, it looks like they're in some stage of reproduction process, the reproduction cycle. But that's a big debate, and we don't have to get into that. But you find them.
Right.
In almost every house, they may not be complete, they might be broken.
Yeah.
But you do find them.
What would be the correlation with those figurines? Would it be to a Canaanite god? Would it be?
Right. Well, that's a big, you know, discussion. Some scholars would say that the figurines represent a Canaanite fertility goddess, in particular Asherah.
Okay.
The women of the household would use that figurine as part of their prayers to Asherah in order to secure safe conception and pregnancy and birth.
Okay.
Right. So there is that connection with the reproductive cycle there. And some scholars think that maybe they are representatives of their ancestors, and that gets into the whole, you know, reverence of ancestors and within their culture. So there's a few different ideas out there.
Yeah.
But, you know, you find them in the homes, and you find other things related to religion in the home. So to have that idea that the Israelites were going just to Jerusalem to worship once the temple was built, or once even the centralization of Jerusalem as the local place, as the place to worship Yahweh, that's not what the archaeological record is showing. It shows that people, of course, they're not going to travel by foot, you know, for a week or so to get to Jerusalem to go offer a sacrifice. They're going to either go to a more local shrine, which we do have those, but then there's also a lot of evidence that they're conducting worship at home too.
At home. Now, within those, with the figurines and stuff, do you also find items that are more associated with Judaism? I mean, like, did they have a lot of symbols at that time?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I'm trying to think of some examples. I mean, if you're in a household, in a house, You're pretty poor.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're not going to have a lot.
Yeah.
Things related to Judaism, I mean, you might get some like little model shrines that might have some symbols on them, like the date palm, of course, is pretty popular, pomegranate. No. Later, there's one occasion, I think, at Kirbet Kiafa where they found a model shrine that might have had an image of possibly an ark. I'm trying to recall correctly, but I'm not really sure about that one. But no, not a lot of imagery.
Well, right?
And that seems like a tricky thing to evaluate because they weren't supposed to be worshiping Yahweh with any kind of representation.
Right,
so
right,
if
yeah.
they were worshiping Yahweh along with these other figurines and idols, then we wouldn't have the evidence for that.
Right.
And then often, too, and we know this from the Second Commandment, they would think of these representations as Yahweh. So Exodus 32, when Moses comes down, Aaron says, you know, he's talking to the Israelites, he's saying, this is your Lord, this is your Yahweh.
Yeah.
Right.
The calf was, they thought they were worshiping Yahweh.
Right. Yeah,
they said, make us an image of this God that saved us, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And those calves that we find, you know, people, whenever you see these big pictures of, you know, the golden calf, and there's these huge golden calves, and it's like, well, when we find these calves, they're like, you know, just a couple inches.
Right, yeah. Is that like a zoomed in picture?
You know?
You zoom out and it's on a desk.
It's like they're pretty little, you know.
Yeah.
And even if you find them over, because they're usually made out of terracotta, you know, pottery.
Yeah.
And they're fired and all that stuff, but they're not big at all. And so when we see these artists' rendition of, you know, the golden calf, and you're like,
maybe not. That would have been
probably not
a
life-size.
Lot of earrings to make
it
that golden calf that big.
Yeah, but then you get in places, you do get inscriptions. Like I'm thinking of the inscription down at Cantilla Ashrud, which was a kind of fortress down in the southern part of Israel near Arad, like in the desert where really not a lot of people live, but you get a lot of caravans for trade and stuff. And so they think this Cantilla Ashrud place was a kind of almost like a truck stop, but for an ancient truck stop. And there seems to be a place for worship in there. And there's inscriptions that talk about Yahweh and his Asherah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so if we're talking about syncretism, where people, you know, Israel, of course, is called to worship the one true God, but again, really struggled with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're looking for evidence of that, you've got it in the text and you've got it in the archaeological record.
Right. Yeah. And it does seem to be that story of God calling them to worship and then them working that out in their experience, and
then
seeing their neighbors probably with figurines and trying. Do we find figurines in other, maybe that we know in our non-Jewish homes, or
you can't really tell if they're Israelite or Canaanite.
Yeah, Canaanite.
There's no way you can tell because their material culture is pretty much the same.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting.
Which then gets into that whole
little debate there, but well, I think that's good for us to think about now, because we have so many maybe symbols of Christianity that could be in our home you know, thousands of years from now, someone could find, you know, in a track home in the suburbs and find this home that's been preserved and crosses might be on. And so some like these kind of clear symbols that would be like, oh, this would be a Christian home. And we have to remind ourselves, that for their experience, for one, they're going off of, maybe they actually followed that commandment of not making an image of Yahweh. But then we're still maybe influenced by the people around them and that, I think that desire to have, to hold something, right?
Sure.
And to have their
bases
covered. I think it was physical, like you said, but
also. Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it was kind of like insurance, you know? Yeah,
absolutely.
I'm pretty sure Yahweh will protect us, but just in case.
Just in case, yeah.
Yeah, these other gods seem to have helped our Canaanite neighbors.
Right.
Let's cover our bases.
Yeah, and that's kind of piggybacking off of what Libby just said. I tell the kind of analogy I give my students is, well, if you're just trying to survive, right? They're all agriculturalists and pastoralists, and trying to survive off the land is very difficult.
Yeah.
And if you're, you know, we know that, you know, Israel lived in the land and so did the Canaanites. And that if your field of, let's say, barley isn't doing so well, and your Canaanite's neighbor's field is doing really well. And you can imagine the commercial. Hey, neighbor, why is your field doing so well? Well, I worship, I send a say of prayer and libation offering to Asherah every morning. Oh, okay, great. I'm going to say a prayer to Yahweh and I'm going to say a prayer to Asherah.
Right.
And just like Libby said, cover my bases.
Yeah, that just to, and it seems that that pull would be really strong to do that, especially, I mean, we're on such a different end of the historical spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. We've seen that history. Mm-hmm. We now have all of those stories that we can read. We have Jesus, we have New Testament. And so for us, maybe we're less tempted to cover our bases in that way. I think we cover our bases in other ways, by like our bank account and things like that. Like we put our trust in those.
Exactly. It's always an issue of trust.
Mm. Yeah. And it really is. And this, the story of the ancient Hebrew people would be a story of learning trust in this Yahweh in the midst of all of these other gods that people around them are worshiping and are following and either getting benefits from or not. Mm-hmm. And then that call is, no, worship me above them. I am above those gods. Mm-hmm. And I think it seems to be that process of God continually showing his faithfulness, right? And for them to experience all those times of walking away and then learning from that.
Yeah, and imagine how hard it would be, though, too, that if you're called, you know, to worship this one God, and you're not used to that, and everyone around you is worshiping multiple gods.
Yeah.
And you can imagine, I try to imagine at least, about how difficult that would be.
Right.
To say, okay, everyone around me is doing this, and I'm supposed to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that would be really hard.
Especially if it seems to be working for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
It's easy, I think, for moderns to look back and think about how just silly it seems to worship idols. But what they represented and the practical benefits they seem to have and the kind of peer pressure that you're talking about, Cynthia,
it would be very
tempting.
Yeah, I mean, they represented their livelihood and their... the crops, fertility, all of that.
Right. Yeah.
And God knew that would be a huge temptation, which is why he said, you've got to totally get rid of all those Canaanite practices when you go into the land. Mm-hmm. And they didn't.
Yeah.
And they were a constant snare throughout Israel's history.
Right.
Yeah. So it seems to be, okay, we've understood the disconnect between our current definition and their experience. And I think that is really, because I think actually the way it's presented for the ancient Hebrew people is actually helpful for us today. Mm. And Libby, it's like you're saying, it's taking it out of the theoretical and putting it into the practice of worship.
Mm-hmm.
That call from God is the same. You know, don't just believe that I'm the only God who exists, but worship me above. And I think for us, you know, and this is that transition for us now, you know, we don't have a lot of little figurines in our house that we're worshiping or we're tempted to worship that. Maybe religiously the temptation would be to not worship anything, right? Like that. But there are so many idols and things that get in the way of us worshiping God alone.
Right.
And I think the idea of trust is a good way to identify what those idols are in our life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are we trusting in along with God, or maybe even sometimes more than God?
Right.
When we get insecure, we think, I'm pretty sure God's going to help me through this, but I have all this. I'm going to keep saving, be a little bit less generous and keep saving just in case.
Right.
Or whatever that might be for everybody.
Yeah, I think trust is perfect there. And so I think we can maybe note the ancient Hebrew culture was called to worship God alone, called to monotheism, and we can put it back on them. But weren't very good at practicing it.
Right.
They struggled. And maybe the same for us today.
Yeah. Right? We have to ask, what are our idols?
Yeah. And it would be, it would be interesting because I love to think of it through the lens of archaeology. So
me too.
You know, I know. I knew you would. So, you know, when I was young, I had a long list of things that I wanted to do
or
be. One of them was a botanist. Don't know. I just, you know, somehow was a plant. And that helped me for like a 6 month period. I like my mom's plant had a fungi in it and I made it healthy. Wow. I read an encyclopedia and, you know, and I was like, maybe I want to be a botanist. And then that faded. But archaeologist was always one that was on my list. Probably because of Indiana Jones, but...
Yeah, well, that's not real.
What?
Hey, don't talk about it. Right. No, you're not allowed to talk about Indiana Jones like that.
You can come on a dig. That'd be great.
I know. That would be great. Yeah. Can I have a bullwhip, like, on my side?
You could, but you would be made
that
fun
guy.
Of.
Yeah, I'd be that guy. I'm not afraid. I'll come with the hat, the leather jacket. Just go with it the whole time. But what I always found that interesting.
It is.
Because especially thinking of our experience now, so thinking 1,000, 2,000 mm-hmm. years from now, what if someone excavated our land? What would they say about us, yeah. right? Like, and even talking about our homes, with maybe having crosses up and all those things, but we also have so much other stuff in our house that our gals would be like, oh, wow, but they had this big rectangle box that was in,
that
the,
was
center
in the center of
everything. Of
everything. That must have been what they worshipped.
Right. All of the Ouch. Chairs are facing this.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
There's even a view from the kitchen.
Yes.
Right?
They have ones in multiple
yes,
rooms.
Yeah. Like, that would be really fascinating.
It would.
To think. I mean, part of archaeology is you find these artifacts and then you're piecing together mm-hmm. how they use them, what value they had in there. And
what their context was. I mean, because if you find something in a house... versus finding something, you know, near a gate or something, you know, it's that makes a big difference in how it's interpreted. But, you know, the joke is when you don't know what it is or what it was used for, it's all cultic. It's all religious.
Yeah, yeah. There you go.
Because we're all looking for that.
Yes, right. Exactly. When you don't know what it is, it must have been used for worship.
Yeah, they must have worshipped that. And then, if we could actually talk to someone, they'd be like, no, that was just
that
a
was
spoon.
My cereal
yeah.
bowl.
Yeah.
Like, no, it's just a game we played.
Yeah, that, you know, it's kind of like Monopoly. Have you ever Monopoly? Yeah, it would be really interesting to see that. Well, I think for me, this conversation has been helpful because, for one, it's helpful if I hear, and maybe for our listeners, if you hear someone say, you know, ancient Hebrews believed in other gods or that, mm-hmm. you can be like, okay, let's put this in context, mm-hmm. right? The ancient Hebrew textually, archaeologically, definitely struggled with worshiping other gods, right? And that was a struggle, and we see that, and I think the application to us too is that we do the same thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, we may not call them gods, but we struggle with putting our trust in other things, mm-hmm. and so in that way, we find common ground that we are monotheists philosophically, theoretically, but we also are bad at it. Even people who are maybe like paid to do it, right? And I joke students all the time, I'm a full-time paid Christian. Like, I literally get paid to say these things. I get paid at my church, right?
That's good.
And yeah, that is good. I appreciate that. But it's even in that, I can realize in my own life the struggle of mm-hmm. putting God above everything else.
Right.
Trusting God above everything else. Like, that is our call, and that is our struggle as well.
And where we struggle and where we fail and where Israel struggled and where they failed, it all points to our need to Jesus. So mm-hmm. it's not like we have to go back and look at Israel's experience as an embarrassment to our theology. No, that actually is a crucial part of our theology.
Right.
It's why Jesus came to reconcile his people to God.
Yeah, that's so great. All right, well, we're going to finish the show today with Libby's already done this segment. So I got a segment. We'll make it specific to Cynthia, but you've already shot me down on this. So, but I'm going to say it anyway.
I don't know what's coming.
I'm going to say it anyway. So this is a segment called Nerdy Would You Rather.
Nerdy Would You Rather.
Okay. So kind of like the traditional Would You Rather.
Yeah.
Just the nerdy edition. And maybe it's nerdy specific to me, but I tried to make it a little more specific in your world.
Okay.
So would you rather have dinner with Howard Carter, who discovered King Tut, mm-hmm. or Indiana Jones? See, I threw in Indiana Jones, but that's because that was my answer.
The character Indiana Jones or Harrison Ford?
that's a great distinction. Either one.
Because I'd take Harrison Ford.
Okay, so
any
yeah.
day of the week. But if it's Indiana Jones and Howard, I'd take Carter.
Howard Carter. Yeah. There we go. What would you talk about? What would you ask him?
Oh, I'd ask him about when he found the tomb and what he was feeling and thinking and all those emotions of finding one of the most amazing discoveries.
Right.
That just how.
It would be just amazing.
It would be. It would be amazing. I know how I feel when I find like little tiny things, but imagine right. finding something amazing yeah. like that. That would just be so cool.
To me, it would be a little bit like Indiana Jones finding something and that feeling
yeah, I'm
that,
sure.
that you would
yeah,
have.
Yeah, but Indiana never found anything. He was always just treasure
hunting. He stole
hunting.
It. Yeah, he was yeah. a treasure hunter.
Yeah.
But it was pretty exciting. It's pretty exciting.
And he's answering.
I feel like he found the Holy Grail. Like that's why I will lay that claim.
Okay, all right,
he found the actual Holy Grail.
And the crystal skull.
And the crystal skull. Well, that's it gets bad.
It
right.
Does
it gets bad.
Bad.
It gets bad after the Holy Grail.
It does.
We can just stop there.
So that's a nerdy question for you, Mark. Would you rather, if you were Indiana
Jones?
I like
to turn yeah. the
yes. Would you rather find the Ark of the Covenant or the Holy Grail?
Oh, wow. Well, I would be
steal.
I would put it in a museum. Like it wouldn't. I would sell it to a museum. I would be. I mean, based on my research from the movies, I would be terrified to find the Ark of the Covenant.
Yes.
Like, if I found it, I would maybe cover it back up and
yes.
be like, "We're gonna move on."
Yeah.
And no one looked directly at
we're
it.
We're gonna pretend we didn't find this.
Yeah. So the Holy Grail. Now yeah. I would. Yeah, I would be terrified to find the Ark of the Covenant. I would like to find the Holy Grail, especially if there is like, some type of 11th century knight guarding it too, who's like 2,000
bonus.
Years old. Like that would be amazing, just to talk to him about his experience, because that would
how comfortable would be another... is that chainmail you're wearing?
Yeah, exactly. It has to be heavy. It has to be heavy. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome,
I think it was
Mark.
Really good. I love both of your expertise in this area. And you will be back on the show for sure. So,
and we'll be friends
so, yeah,
of the show.
Yeah, you will be a friend of the show when you return. Thank you for listening to Jessup Think. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Jessup Think. We would love to hear your thoughts on the episode and engage with any questions you have. Our aim is to provide a framework for further reflection and deeper exploration of these important topics. You can also help the show by leaving a review on iTunes. These reviews help the podcast reach new listeners. Until next time, I'm Mark Moore, and this is Jessup Think.
If you're interested in learning more about Jessup, please visit us at jessup.edu. William Jessup is the premier, fully accredited, four-year Christian university in the Sacramento area, offering over 60 academic programs in undergraduate and graduate studies, designed to see every student equipped and transformed into the leader they are called to be. As you go, don't forget to hit subscribe and share so you never miss an episode. Thanks for joining us for Jessup Think.